Fischler followed, that will cause them to subject themselves to the judgment of the living God.
Now, questions or comments, then?
Exodus here, and it really is a path of salvation, as a rest and not
second. I would say it's more than a type. It is salvation. What is their deliverance? What is their salvation? It was their salvation, of course, physically, but it was their salvation spiritually. That's because of their belief. And what you have, for example, at the end of chapter 14, relation to their seeing the works of God and their worshiping Him and believing, they believed in Him, and they sang the song of Moses, which you've taken the page, have you? No, okay. When we looked at that, we saw the relationship between that and the song of Moses and the Lamb in the Revelation 15. Now that's called the song of Moses and of the Lamb. And they sang that great song in which they expressed their faith in Yahweh. It's a Yahweh song. The Lord is His name. This is Yahweh. See, we believe this is Yahweh. That's salvation, spiritually. Not only physically, but spiritually. So it's not a type of it. It is salvation. So those who were delivered and saved back there got them in a tremendous unbelief and rebellion, and they were destroyed by God. I'm not going to conjecture about the eternal destiny. I don't want to do that to God. What he's suggesting here is that you certainly don't want to duplicate that kind of thing. And I certainly would not want to take my chances, even though I engage in this apostasy here, God is one except I myself have serious doubts about it.
And he implying here, though, that their eternal destiny is not
themselves. Well, I think so. I think so. That's my thought. If they engage in this.
You mean the
Israelites? I think probably so. I would hesitate to push it that far. For one thing, the whole generation is wiped out. Were they all equally rebellious, unbelievers, etc.? Maybe so. I don't know. But I think one at least is on somewhat risky ground. One absolutizes what happened to all of those spiritually who were destroyed physically. Pardon me? Yes, he did. Whether those were the only true believers in the whole generation, but as I say, I wouldn't risk it. I wouldn't argue because they weren't all destroyed. You might be able to get away with it now. I think that would be a pretty dangerous kind of argument. And by the way, we'll see in chapter 6 that the kind of thing he talks about, which by the way is based on the ultimate revelation, final revelation, complete revelation of Christ, really amounts to crucifying the Son of God afresh. That's pretty serious. Can't get more serious than that. That's the kind of thing he's talking about. So in terms of these people here, it's pretty clear what they would be guilty of would be a pretty serious kind of thing. Okay, let's move now to the more positive exhortation, which is sort of antidote. Or in a way, a means of carrying the other one out. And what he is urging here is a communal or corporate kind of thing. Because what he says in terms of this action that he urges upon them, you know, we're analyzing here. Are you clear that we're doing analysis here? Are you getting used to what we mean by analysis? In terms of taking these things apart, some of their components, and trying to identify the essence of each and put a label on each. Exhort one another. This is a mutuality of encouragement. Admonition, as if you won't make it if you go it alone. Of course, there's a lot in the New Testament to indicate that. We'll go on to talk about that, as we shall see later on, after chapter 10, in terms of meeting together, etc. The fact that we need each other in order to avoid this kind of apostasy. And again, you have the present imperative. You've got to do this continually. Do it continually. The moment you say, I stand and I cannot fall, that's when you're in the state of danger of falling. You're looking awry. And the present element, the linear element, the progressive element, is underlined by the frequency of the action. Do this each day. Absentize that, but you ought to do it pretty frequently. Not once a year, but pretty frequently. And then the purpose of the action, and there are three things emphasized there. One, the scope, that none of you may be hardened. And this business of hardening is involves a process. And by the way, the means by which one is hardened is by the delusion caused by sin. And when you look at the Israelites, one of the delusions of the sinning of the Israelites was the idea that they could continually murmur and continually disbelieve, and that somehow their hearts would not become hard. This is the way sin deceives us. But there is this law of atrophy, this process of cardiosclerosis. Every time you rebel against God, you become more rebellious in heart. And ultimately, you become a rebel. Sin is cumulative. And of course, the devil wants to convince us it isn't. A little sin here, a little sin there won't do any damage. Yes, it will. Cumulative. So this mutual admonition is to avoid this kind of cardiosclerosis. Then he gets in 14 following to substantiations for both exhortations, although in part it's substantiation. Begins by substantiating 12 and 13, this need to beware constantly and to admonish each other constantly. It begins by the fact of the assertion regarding their experience, we share Christ, again conditionally, if, here he comes back to what he started out with in 3:6b following, if we hold fast or firm the object of their action, our original assurance. Now you see what happened was that originally they did have this confidence, this assurance. But what's happening is that they're going downhill. And he said, if you don't watch out, you'll go downhill so far, you'll get to the place where you're like the Israelites. Hard hearts, having lost your assurance. After all, when the Israelites said, as they did in the wilderness, in Numbers 13 and 14, the reason why God has gotten us into this predicament is because he wants to destroy us. So let's go back to Egypt. I mean, when you reach that place, you can't go any lower, can you? God hates us. That's why we're here. Can you imagine that? For all that God had done for them. They had hit bottom as far as their confidence in God was concerned when they started puning God's motives. Now be careful, you're sliding, you're drifting. See, put it 2 under 4, you're drifting. You're sliding from your assurance, from your security, from your anchor. And the danger is that you'll hit rock bottom, as did the Israelites. So what you've got to do is to persevere, hold firm, hold fast, hold steady. In other words, the course of action should involve this course, or indeed, if you want to say it in terms of what ultimately ought to be the case, this course. It ought to be a growing assurance. Not only the same assurance now that you once had, but a growing assurance. And that, I'll just round this out when I come to any questions or comments you might have, sometimes, to the very end. Not, you know, for a while. There's got to be kind of perseverance that extends to the very end.
And here again, he emphasizes this element of opportunity at the time of their actions, while God is still saying today, while it is today. Because once tomorrow arrives, the opportunity is lost. There came a tomorrow for the Israelites at Kadesh Barnea. They had done what they had done, and God says, this is it. I'm through with this generation. Now, there was no point in that generation saying to God, now wait a minute, God, let's back up. We're sorry. Now, there comes a tomorrow. He says, don't wait until tomorrow. Do it while it is today, while the opportunity is here. What questions, comments?
About an interpretation of the word first confidence.
Yeah.
I was not sure about the meaning of this word, so I started checking lexicon. And the lexicon rejected this meaning by saying there is no meaning of confidence in one of our processes. And I checked the several resources, like Kilo. And Kilo saying positive is the essential meaning of positive. Reality of God means Christ, faith in Christ or whatever it is.
Elaborate. What do you mean by that? Can it be Christ? What? How would you paraphrase it if it means Christ, which is objective, is over against the subjective element of assurance of the reality or the substantiality of Christ?
Like God.
How would you paraphrase it?
Like Israel. When they reject the commandment of God from God at Kadesh Barnea, actually they and they lost the reality of God. I mean, they faced this strong, difficult situation, and they could believe the promise of God. But among them, God was revealing His miracles all the way from Egypt and showing His presence to them. But they accumulatively, they lost God's presence. That they don't feel that God is working within them. So like this case, Christ is working for their salvation. And they have a message, and they were feeling that Christ is present in them. And they, right now they lost it.
So, I take it, what you're saying is that it should read, if only we hold Christ firmly to the end. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I'm asking if that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're indicating is a possible reading of it. Hypostasis is used in different ways. Hypostasis has to do basically with the essence or the substance or the reality of a thing. However, it is used derivatively in terms of confidence in that reality. See? Now, for example, hypostasis is used in 11.1. Eston de pistis epixomenon hypostasis. Now, faith is the assurance of things not seen. That is to say, the conviction that things are real. Things are substantial, even though they're unseen, you see? So that assurance and substantiality or reality are inseparable. If you have no assurance, you're saying, this is unreal. If you have assurance, you're saying, this is real, this is reality, this is substantial, you see? So, it's true in a sense that hypostasis does not mean assurance. The concept of assurance is derived from hypostasis.
So the interpretation confidence is about it.
I think so, yeah. Confidence or assurance in the reality of Christ and of God. The subjective is based on the objective. In other words, if I have assurance in something, I'm saying that something is real. See, the object in which I have assurance is real, which I have confidence is real. So I think the subjective element is emphasized here, although it is true that if one loses one's assurance of Christ, one loses Christ. See, that's why he says here, at the beginning of 14, we share in Christ if only we hold our first confidence, our first assurance. Because we lose that assurance, we lose Christ. So you can't have Christ without confidence in Christ, or faith in Christ. There's no way of having Christ without faith in Christ. So the two are bound up to it together. And I would think that whatever is involved in apostasis here, it certainly requires confidence. So it isn't that we're saying that this is purely subjective without any objective reality, which is its counterpart, but rather the emphasis is on the subjective because the subjective is bound up with the objective reality. So you lose the confidence, you lose the reality in the Christ. You do not have confidence, you're denying the reality of Christ. Just as the Israelites were denying God's reality. And when they lost confidence, they said, God isn't God. God cannot defeat the Canaanites. So, well, they were losing God. Or as the Old Testament often puts it, God ends up being afar off instead of near. They lose contact with God. They lose the help of God in this whole process. So my inclination would be to move toward the subjective dimension, although the other is necessarily bound up with it. You can't separate the two. Okay?
Would it follow then that one could not be a Christian without having assurance of salvation?
I hesitate to make that kind of statement. The emphasis here is not so much on assurance of salvation as it is on confidence in Christ and Christ's effectiveness and Christ's adequacy. Christ is functioning as my high priest, and Christ can do for me what needs to be done. I would hesitate to say if someone has some doubts, you know, about salvation, which really could amount to doubts not as to Christ's reality or adequacy, but doubts as to whether we are doing what we need to do, you see, that person isn't saved. And of course, then you have to start defining doubts anyway. I think Dr. Siemens has been doing us a great service in this series of sermons on doubt, because very often we misunderstand what doubt really means. It can have all kinds of causes. In fact, very often it's the believer who doubts because he has something to believe in, which he can doubt. See? So I would hesitate to make the assertion that unless one is completely assured of salvation, one doesn't have salvation. It's really Christ that's the focus here. His adequacy. That's the issue. Okay? Let's move then to the further substantiation in 16 and 19, which perhaps substantiates the substantiation of 14 and 15. Although in turn, of course, it substantiates the exhortation. In other words, sometimes what you have in an hortatory pattern is this. You have an exhortation here, which is substantiated. But then you have a substantiation of the substantiation. So this substantiates this, but this substantiates this. But of course, the substantiating this, since this substantiation substantiates the exhortation, it also substantiates the exhortation, but indirectly, you say. In other words, you might give reasons for an exhortation which themselves need to be supported. Okay? So what he is doing here is saying, in effect, let's go through it, and I have a paraphrase at the end which will indicate this. Here again, he substantiates the conditional statement of 14 and 15, namely, we share Christ only if we continue to hold firm to this first confidence we have to the very end. The reason why I say that is because of my comparing your experience with that of the Israelites, and because of what happened to the Israelites. Now, there are three emphases there in 16 to 19, and they're intermingled, but there are three emphases. Who, the identity of those of whom he is speaking, these Israelites, they heard God. Look at it, these were the people who were at Sinai, to whom Moses said, I'm going to take you to hear the voice of God. These were the people to whom God spoke in a personal way. Heard God. They were delivered from Egypt under Moses' leadership. Well, that's, you have to read under the lines there, you see. With Moses, with whom he had compared and contrasted Jesus in 3, 1 to 6a, well, Moses didn't cut it. The other side of the coin is that they had Moses, this great man. So they were delivered. I'm talking about what's right here. Now, why did they experience what they experienced? Because of their rebellion, because they sinned, because they were disobedient. I mean, these are the things you pick up from the statement. Are you following me? Who were they that heard and yet were rebellious? Was it not all those who left Egypt under the leadership of Moses? That's the people that were involved among the Israelites. And with whom was he provoked 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned? And to whom did he swear that they should never enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? Those. The who, the why, and these two could be combined and bracket them, because they, of course, involve the same thing, essentially. And then the what, the result, the emphasis on the judgment of God. God was provoked by them. Their bodies fell. They had no rest. Now, let me paraphrase 3:16 to 19 for you to illustrate paraphrase, but also to indicate the thrust of the reasoning here. And by the way, Jed here, aren't you Jed? Jed here is going to make the attempt, he indicates, to type these transparencies and have them available for the whole class. It would be a great thing if he's able to do that. He doesn't want to commit himself, and I don't want to commit him either. He's going to make the attempt. That's all we can ask. And, but let's see, who else talked with me? You talked with me, Weston, about the matter of duplicating these. So one way or the other, these transparencies will be available, either in typed form or simply the duplication of the present form. Wes had kindly offered to do that, so we'll have them available at the end of the course of study. The reason you are, something you are to persevere to the end in order to share Christ and all he makes possible, that's the exhortation he gave, the reason he gave the exhortation, is that what happened to the Israelites can happen to you. They were delivered from Egypt, but their confidence in God wavered. With the result, they rebelled against him and were consequently destroyed by him. See? He's giving a reason for the reason, which in turn supports the exhortation. So what you have then here are really two main emphases in these materials. One, that apostasy for the recipients of this treatise, this letter, is possible, just as it was possible for the Israelites. There's your comparison, say. Then comes the contrast, that apostasy is avoidable. If we follow a different course, a different path from the Israelites, if we learn from the Israelites, God wants us to learn from the Israelites. In fact, the story is told to teach us not to do what the Israelites did. That's the purpose of the story. This is education via negativa, by the negative route. Tell the story of what shouldn't be done as a means of telling people avoid what shouldn't be done. A lot of the scriptures is like that. Okay, any questions and comments now on what we've been seeing here? Yes, the concept of once saved, always saved. In fact, the concept of universalism, I think, logically follows from certain views of the atonement. You see, the moment you say, as the hymn says, I think I understand what the hymn is saying, and the author of Hebrews, in a way, says the same thing, what Christ did, he did once for all. But when you say 'tis done, the great transaction's done. As if it's some kind of transaction of the past. Once it's done, it's done. It can't be undone. Once you say it that way, then of course, regardless of what happens, regardless of any apostasy, regardless of any wavering, regardless of any lack of perseverance, 'tis done, the great transaction's done, you say. And if you take seriously biblical statements, the great transaction is done for all human beings, then you see where it leads, universalism. No, the fact is that atonement, at-one-ment, is a relationship. And here I emphasize, let me emphasize what I've emphasized in other classes, and that is that when the biblical mode of thinking is interpersonal and relational. So if you want to find the kind of analogy which will illuminate biblical thought, think in terms of human interpersonal relationships. Think in terms of human reconciliation when there's hostility. What needs to happen? Well, the whole process needs to be bilateral, doesn't it? The most beautiful image that's used, if you do with this, I'll turn this off. The most beautiful image that's used biblically to indicate this is the use of the image of marriage from the area of interpersonal relations. And Hosea is built on that image. What happens in a marriage? What happened in Hosea's case when Gomer either was adulterous to begin with, harlotress, or became adulterous, whichever the situation might be, and it's problematic. What happened? Well, what happens is that you have here the offended party and the offending party, and if there's to be a reconciliation, and this is true of all hostile relationships, well, let's think in terms of a marriage now. What has to happen is two things. One, there has to be a dual movement. So Hosea has to move toward Gomer, but that's not enough. Let's back up. Say, Hosea can't sit at home and say to Gomer, wherever she is, you know, practicing her harlotry, or send some messenger to her and say, Gomer, I forgive you, but please don't come home. No, that's forgiveness without forgiveness. Forgiveness without forgiveness. He has to go to Gomer. And he has to say to Gomer, I forgive you. I want you to come back home. Live with me as my wife. I'm willing to do this. Very difficult. Very difficult. Many marriages, just one act of infidelity. That's the end of it. People cannot forgive. Even Christians cannot forgive. So there has to be this forgiveness. But even that can happen. Gomer can say, no thank you, and there's no marriage, no reconciliation. So Gomer has to move toward Hosea. And willing to accept Hosea's forgiveness and return and be his wife. But that can't be a once-for-all act either, you see. That's got to be an ongoing thing. That's got to be a relationship. The relationship has to be amended, has to be repaired, but then it has to continue because, of course, Gomer can go out and do the same thing again. So it has to be mended, but then has to be ongoing, you see? And that's the way it has to happen with regard to our relationship to God. There has to be this bilateral relationship, but then that's the beginning of a relationship which has got to be continued. It's never a once-for-all thing. Some of these views of atonement are once-for-all things. Okay? Justification, regeneration is once-for-all. Once you're born, you can't be unborn. That kind of misuse of the imagery of regeneration, rebirth, that's a misuse of it. That presses it too far beyond what it's meant to be. Beyond what it means. So this is the way it happens in interpersonal relations. This is the way it happens, I think, with regard to the way in which God works. This is the process.
How is the possibility of apostasy reconciled with Jesus saying that most sheep of this nation are I presume that's really just a general security.
No, you can get it. I mean, if you interpret that passage in a certain way, or interpret the passage at the end of Romans 8, nothing can separate from the love of God and Christ, etc., in a certain way, you can arrive at that concept. But I think in all of those cases, what is being addressed is some external force that, without your desire and volition being involved, without your choice being involved, somehow severs you from God. Of course, that's impossible. The only thing that can sever you from God is you yourself. You can choose to sever yourself from God. That's the only one. God will never sever himself from you. We can be sure of that. Nothing external to us can sever us from God. We don't want to be severed. The only thing that can sever us from God is we ourselves. That's the thing that's being addressed in those statements. When Paul lists all those things in Romans 8, he says, none of these things can separate us, not if we walk in the Spirit. Who's us? Those of us who are walking in the Spirit. That's the context of it. Not those of us who are walking in the flesh. That doesn't make any sense, you see. Those of us who are walking in the Spirit, then we cannot be separated from something external to us. It's a matter of our relationship with God. So nothing can separate two partners in a marriage except those two partners themselves. See? They can go through thick and thin and maintain the marriage if they want the relationship. I think one has to take those things in context. Otherwise, one can use them as one can use almost any biblical statement any way one wants. Well, we better let you go. We have been late already. Thank you. Have a good weekend. And we'll plan on seeing you on Tuesday. Let's move then to 4:1 following, and let's begin by having one of you paraphrase the therefore of 4:1. And you might want to use the causal formula up here as a means of indicating what's involved in that relationship and in the statement of 4:1 that flows from that relationship. I wonder if you would do that for us, please. Todd? All right.
Because the cause has been there pretty much summarized in chapter 3, and it's illustrated by the people of Israel, because they disobeyed, and when they fell away from the living God, they did not enter the rest. And ultimately, they did not enter the rest. Okay, so because they disobeyed, did not enter rest. Therefore, the fall of that we should, and follow this exhortation, guard against the fear, that's going to be judged.
All right, you've got the essence of it. What you need to do is clean up the statement so it's more precise. So it might read like this, and really it attaches to the very end of 3, although, of course, the end of 3 really is a thrust of the whole of 3, particularly beginning with 3:7b. Because Israelites were unable to enter the rest of God due to their belief, it follows that you should be careful, be on your guard, lest you too fail to enter the rest of God because of unbelief. So the exhortation flows from the experience of the Israelites, with which he closes chapter 3. And of course it involves really comparison, namely that their experience could be comparable to that of the Israelites if they aren't careful. If they don't fear. If they aren't concerned, deeply concerned about the possible consequences of their actions. See what I mean by cleaning it up? And the kind of thing you did at first is the kind of thing I found on the papers. And that kind of thing provides the wherewithal to paraphrase, but the paraphrase ought to be a clear-cut statement in which you indicate what the causes are in this case, or cause is, and what the effect is that flows from that cause. You see how my statement binds the two together. Okay, thank you, Todd. You did well, particularly since you didn't have that before you. What the passage starts out with, then, is this exhortation that, as we have just indicated, flows from what precedes, the result of what precedes. Let's have you continue with us here now, Todd, to analyze the exhortation itself. What are the various components of it? Try to put some label on them to see what is there in verse 1.
It's a temporal statement. It makes a promise to be in the present, and it doesn't remain. We still have a possibility of entering the rest.
All right, so actually that element of time or opportunity, as we indicate here, for the action for which he calls in the exhortation, while the promise of rest remains, which implies what, with regard to what the possibilities are? Might not always remain. That's a significant element here. So there's an element of urgency involved here, and there is a warning regarding delay. Don't put it off and say, well, if we don't do it today, we'll do it eventually. Maybe there's some reason for our coming into this confident status that we need, and that reason will emerge later on, but today we don't have that reason, so we're going to postpone the kind of confidence he's talking about. Rather, he says, it's urgent that you do it immediately while the opportunity exists. And then you have, of course, the action itself, and the fear of be careful, be on our guard. And then what is the subsequent element? Lest any of you be judged.
The fact that there will be judgment.
All right, and what structurally, how is that statement, part of the statement, related to what precedes? Substantiation indirectly, but more directly what's involved.
Contrast.
There is contrast too, but how might you paraphrase that? Let us fear. How might you paraphrase that part of it? The exhortation is, let us fear.
You're talking about the last one.
Yes.
Not one of those.
Do you recall what we did with regard to 2.1 to 4, where you have a similar kind of construction in 2.1? We must pay the closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. Recall how we paraphrase that?
No.
Okay, does someone remember the paraphrase, Charles? Do you remember? Yes, how would you paraphrase it? In order that you may not drift away from it. So basically you have the same kind of construction here. In other words, the action is a means to an end. In order, if you want to put it another way, in order that none of you may be judged to have failed to reach it. So you have here really purpose or end, which really involves an indirect substantiation. Again, because if of course, you realize that this is the purpose of the action. That purpose will then provide a reason for taking the action. You can say also because to follow this course of action means that you will avoid failing to reach God's rest. Okay. Now there is a contrast here, as you suggest, but the contrast is very implicit. Let us fear that we may enter God's rest, and not fail to reach it. There is that too. So you have another number of implicit relationships here. But basically, what he's indicating is the element of purpose, and with that substantiation. Okay? It's good to have you. Sir, what's your name?
Roger Johnson.
All right, what's your work? Good. Where are you located? Wabash Conference. Good to have you here today. We're working with Hebrews 4 today. Do you have a Bible with you, perchance? Does someone have one that you can lend? Thank you. Okay, are we clear then, Todd, on what we've done? All right, let's move then to the succeeding verse, in verse 2. Thank you, Todd. Let's move to someone else now. I wonder if you would pick up for us here, Fred. How is that statement related to what precedes?
It's the substantiation of the exhortation 4.1 and the substantiation of the contract.
All right, very good. The contrast is indicated where in the statement 4.2.
The contrast indicated in the bud, of course, 4.2.
Now, are there any other relationships involved in that substantiating statement?
There's comparison.
All right, the comparison is indicated in the just as. For good news came to us, just as to them, the Israelites. What else do you have? The because. So you have contrast, but within the contrast, you also have comparison and substantiation.
Yeah.
Now, what are the points he makes here by way of supporting the previous exhortation, in light of this structure that we pointed out?
One is that the good news came to us, compared to just as it came to them. So we know about it.
All right, we know about what now?
We know that we can't fall away, that apostasy is possible.
Now, is that good news?
No, that's not good news. That's the negative part. The positive part is that the promise that remains, the promise of rest remains.
Exactly. In other words, and here, by the way, he's really stating the two main points of the entire chapter. One is that we, like the Israelites, have the good news of the promise of rest. Now, by the way, we won't take the time to do it, but if you look at the book of Joshua, the book of the conquest of Canaan, you'll find that one of the key words there is the word rest. You have it at the very outset, I will give them rest. So the Israelites were promised rest. The promise of rest, which involved Canaan for the Israelites, is not limited to Canaan, the Israelites and Canaan, but is open to us now. And that's a very significant element, particularly in view of the possibility that the Hebrews tended to associate the rest with Canaan, the land of Canaan itself. And he, as we shall see, he moves away from that concept, divorces rest from the land of Canaan. And that's why it's open to the Hebrew Christians to whom he's speaking, indeed open to every Christian, in light of what he goes on to say. Now, what, and of course, if this rest is not available to them, then, as these Hebrew Christians, then the point of the exhortation is completely lost and really non-existent. So that the promised rest must be available for the Hebrew Christians. Otherwise, there's no point in being on the guard, lest they miss it. You can't miss what is not available to you. So, now, what's the point of the second part of the statement?
The but. Well, the message didn't benefit them, is the point of that. And the reason being, it didn't benefit them, it's substantiated to them, but the cause, read the message they heard that did them no good is that it did not meet the faith.
All right, very good. Did you notice the paraphrase using that formula we gave you up here? Very good. So the two emphases then is that you, like the Israelites, still have available the promise of rest. But you, like the Israelites, may miss that promised rest if you engage in unfaith, unbelief, as they did. Okay? All right. Now put this whole package together, Fred, if you will, and use this substantiatory paraphrase here with regard to relating verse 2 and its various parts to verse 1, the exhortation there.
Mixed,
you could literally say mixed with faith, or joined with faith. Okay, that's good. Here again, I would do two things, and that is to use your own language a little more freely, as over against looking at the text, and secondly, to make it as crisp and as clean as possible. It might read like this: the reason why we ought to be on guard lest we miss the rest is that we do have the promised rest available to us, just as the Israelites did, but just as they did, we may miss that rest by unbelief, because we do not join the promise, the message, with faith. You see? Okay, are we coming along in our understanding of paraphrase, what we mean by paraphrase?
If I use my notes, I've got mine.
Don't be afraid to read from your notes if you have your notes before you. because that, we would like to have examples of statements that are well thought through and as clear as possible. Don't be afraid to read from your notes. You see how this kind of paraphrase helps you understand what's being said and how things are tied together. That's very, very important in this kind of reasoning. Now, what one finds here, and by the way, here I've indicated the two basic elements emphasized in the chapter which are found here, and that is the Hebrews, like the Israelites, do have God's rest available to them. That's the good news. And two, the Hebrews, like the Israelites, can fail to reach it by unbelief. That's the twofold comparison that you have here. Now, the but really involves the fact that they have the promise, but they can fail to realize the promise. That's why the contrast is introduced. But these are the two theses, and of course these two theses are both significant. As I've already indicated, one of the problems of being dealt with here apparently is the view that the Hebrew Christians don't feel they have rest available to them. This may involve a number of things. It may involve this whole idea that the rest is bound up with the land and they don't have the promise of the land available to them, but also the fact they are bound up with the whole Levitical system, which always resulted in turmoil, anxiety, uncertainty. As he goes on to indicate later on, anything that you repeat, that you do over and over again, leaves you wondering whether it works. And, of course, robs you of peace, serenity, tranquility, as over against the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ. He'll make a point of that later. In fact, one of the beautiful things about this epistle is how certain threads are woven through, and the author anticipates what he's going to argue later on. He sort of suggests things to you and then drops them and then comes back to them and elaborates them later on. That's one of the theses he elaborates here. The other idea is that we do have rest, but whether or not we believe it is immaterial. We'll have the rest anyway. So those apparently are the two fallacies that he is intending to meet by the arguments that he uses here. So these, as we shall see, are the two main points he makes throughout the chapter. And particularly in this chapter, he emphasizes the first of these. Now, chapter 3 emphasized the second element here. Now, he says that here, too, as we've just seen in verse 2. But in terms of emphasis, chapter 3 emphasizes number 2. Chapter 4 emphasizes number 1. So it's almost as if, to say, having argued that they, the Hebrew Christians, like the Israelites, and failed to reach the rest of God by their unbelief, there are those who might have asked, well, is that rest really available to us? And is your argument, therefore, really relevant to us? And his answer is, yes, rest is available. That's why my argument is valid and relevant, and that's why you ought to pay attention to what I'm saying. That's why the sequence is reversed in terms of how I've listed these, although logically this would be the first sequence because the second piece opposes the first. There's no point talking about what unbelief will do to you with regard to rest unless rest is available to you. By the way, this indicates the difference between a psychological progression in reasoning and a logical progression. Psychological progression always involves the movement along the timeline, so that certain things always precede other things in experience. And if this argument followed the timeline, he would deal primarily with number one first, and then number two second. But he is following not a psychological sequence, but a logical sequence. Therefore, he addresses the second first, and then moves back by way of emphasis to the second. In chapter 4. Are we clear on that? You hear what I'm saying? And incidentally, that same principle is very significant for a book like Romans, because often the reason for the misunderstanding of Romans 6 to 8, for example, has to do with the fact that people assume that what Paul discusses in chapter 7 follows experientially what he discusses in 6, and what he discusses in chapter 8 follows experientially what he discusses in 6 and 7. That's not true at all. Because if it's ordered logically, in terms of logic, you can move back and forth. That's why you have the law of substantiation possible in logic, whereas in following the sequence of experience, it's always causation, always causes precede effects. But the fact that in logic, you can talk about effects first and then causes later on means that you can reverse the order of experience. So one has to be very careful about assuming that the sequence of the text follows the timeline of experience, of the order of experience, because you do have these two kinds of developments and movements, the psychological type or experiential type on the one hand, the logical type on the other hand, which may, I emphasize may, reverse the sequence of experience. Okay? Now, what we have here in 2, as we have looked at it, the support for the thesis, the failure to realize God's rest is due to unbelief and faith. Faith makes possible entering God's rest. Is based on what we might call a past historical support. So he supports this in the past experience of the Israelites. That's involved in the just as, the comparison, along with the but. And I've indicated the paraphrase here. The reason why I say that we need to be on our guard to avoid fading and reach the rest of God is that it is not enough for us to have and to hear the good news of rest if it is to profit us any more than it was for them. It is as necessary for us as it was for them to be so fully persuaded. That's the meaning of pistis, faith from patho, to be persuaded, to be so fully persuaded that we, what we hear, that we act on it. See the paraphrase there? Did not mix or join faith with hearing, and that was their problem, and that will be, and be your problem, and if so, then you too, like them, will not realize God's rest. Okay, do I see puzzled looks on your faces, or what's the meaning of the expression of faith? Right?
Meaning of faith
is that you're fully persuaded of what we hear. Yes. That's the meaning of faith. Greek word patho, from which both pistis and pistuo come. Pistis, faith, pistuo, to believe, to be so fully persuaded of something that you act on the basis of it, that you entrust yourself to it, that you commit yourself to it. So what the problem with the Israelites was that they heard the message of God through Moses and Joshua and Caleb with regard to God's provision for them if they go into the land as he wants them to go into the land, but they were not persuaded, and so decided not to obey. And by the way, I recall that on one of your papers I indicated that when you analyze Numbers 14, 1 to 35, you find that unbelief is the root cause and disobedience is the result. Failure to obey God, to trust him, to believe that he will really fight for them and overcome the giants, the Nephilim, and the fortified cities, that results in their saying, we're not going in there to be slaughtered. So unbelief is the root cause of sin. And by the way, unbelief has to do with the heart. See, that's the inner element. That's your relationship to God, that's your attitude toward God. And then, of course, disobedience is overt. It's the overt expression of this inner attitude toward God. So always when you talk about unbelief, you're talking about the heart. And this, by the way, goes back to Genesis 3, because the beginning of sin in Genesis 3 is with unbelief. They did not, Eve and Adam did not trust God's motives and God's veracity. They believed the serpent when he said, God is not telling you the truth. He's not trustworthy when he says that you will surely die when you eat of the fruit of the tree. As a matter of fact, he's trying to preserve his own authority and his own uniqueness and his own supremacy. And that's why he's telling you, don't eat of this fruit, because he knows if you do, you'll become like him. knowing good and evil. See, what the serpent is doing is working at this whole matter of trust. You really trust God. You trust Him to be saying what is true and what is for your good. Now, the moment trust is undercut, then disobedience necessarily follows. Now, if God is going out to tell me to cut my own throat, I'm not going to obey Him. It's only if I believe that God is concerned about my well-being. See? If I trust Him and He says, I love you, I'm asking you to do what's good for you, then I have a basis for obedience. That's the movement, you see. So it begins with the heart and then moves out to the external, to the practice. That's the key element with regard to believers' sin. Now, he moves from they as the basis for his argument here, this past historical support, to what I call the present historical experiential support for the assertion that faith makes possible reaching God's rest, where he says, we who have believed are experiencing God's rest or can enter God's rest. Now, I think that they have are experiencing it in terms of the immediate past going into the future is really the best rendering of that. I don't think this is futuristic, because as we shall see, I don't think he's talking primarily about eschatological rest, although that's certainly included. He's talking about a present historical rest. So he says, in effect, look at those of us who are experiencing rest and ask yourself, how did we get there? And the answer is, we got there by faith. That's the key to it. So, the key to the Israelites having experienced rest should have been faith. The reason why they didn't was because of the lack of faith. The key to our experiencing rest now is the same thing, namely faith. So, from both standpoints, then, he has a demonstration of that second thesis, namely that it takes faith. Hearing mixed or joined with faith to experience God's rest. Okay, are we clear on that?
Mental access, heart access.
Yes, both. You can't have merely mental assent. You have to have heart assent in terms of trusting oneself to and trusting oneself to. The Hebrew concept of belief, for example, that you have in Genesis 15:6, comes from a man, which literally means to cause God to support you, to lean on God and cause Him to support you or to provide the foundation for your life. Now, that involves mental assent, but that involves a commitment of your total life, which comes from the heart, the very inner core of your being. Has faith, confidence, and can move back accordingly. Okay? Now, this leads to the issue as to whether the rest of God is still available. As I indicated, he indicates both issues in verse 2, but it's this first issue in 2a to which he turns by way of support. Because apparently he feels that they are challenging the thesis that the rest of God is still available to them. Now, where he begins to do that is problematic. He may begin to do that in 3b. And 3a may involve the second element, namely that it was their unfaith, Israelites' unfaith, that caused them not to enter the rest, and it will be the Hebrews' unfaith that will cause them not to enter the rest. Because he goes back to quoting Psalm 95, he quotes just a part of it, but perhaps he's going back to chapter 3 with all that context to emphasize what is emphasized there. The other possibility is that he's moving into this whole concept of the existence of this rest in 3b, in which case the emphasis is on the future. They shall never enter the rest, my rest. Now, had the psalmist been referring to a past possibility of rest, He would not have used the future tense. He would have said, they did not, or they have not entered my rest. Now the possibility is all over with. But he doesn't say that. He says, they shall never enter my rest, which means the rest of God still continues to exist, which is underlined by what he adds in 3b, going back to creation, namely, that the rest of God began on the seventh day of creation, with God's Sabbath rest after creation. Now you see how he's beginning to divorce rest from the land of Canaan. Because if rest simply involved the possession of the land of Canaan, the conquest of the land, then once they failed to conquer the land, there would have been no rest. And indeed, one might add, since the next generation did conquer the land, there was rest. But he doesn't say that, you see, because the rest is still being offered. So he says, this rest does not involve the land. It's something which begins with God's Sabbath rest after creation and continues to extend until now, and indeed extends into the future. But some kind of universal, timeless rest that he's talking about. It's not associated with the land. So what he is doing then, I've indicated here the other possibilities continue to support the reasons for Peter to enter the rest, at least in 4:3b, quote Psalm 95 in context of what he has said in chapter 3. But I think really he's moving to emphasize the reasons why this rest is still available to them. Now, I've indicated already several of the reasons here that are involved. One is that Psalm 95 uses the future tense versus the past tense. The rest continues, but the Israelites will never enter it because of their unbelief. Of course, that what they did is past and gone. Then Genesis 2:2, in the next part of the verse, in 3c, the Sabbath rest of God, which followed creation, is still continuing. What is the significance of that? Well, the rest of God. The rest of God is based on God's confidence that creation was finished. That's why he rested. So the key to rest is confidence. Conclusion, the third reason he indicates as to why this rest is continuing, is ongoing, is that God's, that the Psalm says today, in the time of David, after the conquest of Canaan. That's after two phenomena. One, after the first generation of the Exodus failed to realize that rest about which the psalm is talking, but even after subsequent generations did realize that rest insofar as it could be realized. And what he's implying, of course, is that it could not really be realized to the fullest extent God intended, even after the land was conquered. And we know that from the history of Israel, don't we? Conquest did not solve all of Israel's problems. There was still not rest. There was tremendous turmoil. So God has in mind a greater kind of rest, as we shall see, a spiritual kind of rest, which begins with creation, is related to the land, is related to the Sabbath day in the law, in Exodus 20, but continues now into the new covenant, even apart from law. We're beginning at the end of this whole discussion, we'll ask ourselves, what is the rest of God he's talking about on the basis of what's being said here? Okay, are we clear on that? Yes.
I'm still a little fuzzy about the fact that the writer says that the Israelites didn't have rest even after the conquest. I see that it's, they could only have partial rest. He says they didn't have any rest at all. It seems to me that
I would. I wonder whether he's saying that they didn't have any rest at all, because what the statements he's making has to do with that first generation, primarily, which of course didn't even enter Canaan. So that's his major thrust. Now, he is implying that subsequent generations not realize rest in the fullest sense. See, so in the fullest sense that God intended in terms of the Sabbath rest after creation. See. So he says, in effect, with regard to subsequent generations, even if they realize the rest of God in a partial sense, it has not been realized in the full sense, and the full realization comes only in relation to Christ in the New Covenant. See. I think that's what he would be saying right here. Any other questions or comments?
Can you explain how the word although have we gotten 3b yet?
Oh yes, we've gotten past 3b.
The word although bothers me. I can't quite put together verse 3 as to how that contrast fits in with reacting.
Well, both, because Psalm 95 is being quoted in 3a. What he is indicating is that the psalmist said regarding these Israelites, that first generation that was delivered from Egypt, they shall never enter my rest, and he said that in spite of the fact that the rest of God began with creation, and he implies is continuing now. See? So that what he is saying is that they failed to avail themselves of that rest, though that rest continues to exist. And of course, the latter part of the statement is really the main point that he's making. And that agrees with the future tense you have there in the next it's both negative and positive. The positive part of it is implicit in the future tense, shall never enter the rest. He says to them, not only they did not, they have not, but they shall not even enter in the future, although that rest still exists, because it began with creation and continues. Because God never started creating again. See, that's the implication.
Yeah, nothing positive for them, though, but positive for us.
Oh yes, yeah, positive for the Hebrew Christians. Yeah, right. Right.
Yes. Although his works were finished, could you put in there, although his works which made possible rest were finished?
Yes, his creative works. In other words, his initial acts of creation were finished. That's why he rested. Now, well, that doesn't mean he began being inactive in every respect. Obviously, he's active redemptively.
That which is necessary to bring creation into
initial creation. Yes.
Seeing the rest as a result of the creation, you begin to have a relationship with that which is
created. That's true. The question would be whether he's emphasizing relationship to creation or inactivity with regard to creation. He seems to be emphasizing the latter. And that means that creation is finished. And as I say, what's implicit there is God's confidence that he had done all that was necessary to create. Otherwise, we've been scurrying about looking for something else to do. The moment he says, it's finished, it's done, I can now go into a state of repose with regard to creation, means his confidence that he's done all this that needs to be done to create. I think it's the state of repose or inactivity, which means confidence in the completion of creation, and the fulfillment of his creative purposes. That's being emphasized here.
I thought of knowing about being finished, that is, known about by God, plans for by God, and confidence.
Yes, exactly. And this goes back to the concept of tov in Genesis 1, good. You recall that over and over again, God looked at the various facets of creation and said with regard to each facet, this is good, and then looked at the total creation and said, this is very good. The meaning of good there, as I was telling someone the other day, as I recall, does not involve righteous. I have serious doubts about the concept of original righteousness. Because the concept of good or tov is not a moral or ethical concept. Rather, it is a telic concept. You have this cosmic artisan or sculptor, and the word for create bara it really means literally to carve or to shape or to form. You have this cosmic artisan, somewhat like a less than cosmic artisan, Michelangelo, taking material and going at that material with some purpose and intent in mind, and shaping it and carving it in terms of his purpose and intent, and then when he's through, he stands back and says, very good. What is he saying?
Exactly.
I've accomplished what I intended to do. It's finished. Michelangelo did that with regard to that beautiful statue of David, which is in Florence. If you haven't seen that, you ought to make it your goal someday to see that beautiful work of art. And you can imagine Michelangelo having this image of what he wanted to do with this piece of marble, finally stood back and said, bono, good. This is exactly what I intended. Now I can sit down. Okay. So that's what's involved, this telic concept, the concept of purpose, intention, and creation, which, when completed, then leads to repose with regard to creation. Not repose with regard to everything else, but repose with regard to creation. Yes, Tov is used in various ways depending on context. In some contexts, it has an ethical connotation. So when you're talking about decisions, choices, etc., then you have an ethical connotation. But with regard to creation, you must remember that God said of the trees, of the animals, all of which are amoral, all of this is very good. And of course, he could not have meant all of this is morally righteous. So it's the context that in Genesis 1 indicates a telic use reserved against other contexts in which the term is used ethically.
Do you think telic?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, depending on context. Okay? Now, let's just paraphrase verse 8 here, which is part of this. Verse 8 supports what precedes, and I paraphrase it here. And I hope that you're now beginning to catch on to what we mean by paraphrase. The reason why I say that David's use of today with regard to entering God's rest, not merely the rest which God provides, by the way, in other words, I would understand the rest of God as not merely the rest which God provides, but the rest in which God himself is engaged, so that we actually share God's rest, God's repose. We aren't merely the recipients of a gift of repose given by God. See the difference? It's the latter, but it's more than that. It's the former, too. Years later than the conquest is that if Joshua had provided rest in the conquest of the land of Canaan, God would not have spoken later through David as a subsequent day of rest. He would not have offered in Psalm 95 another opportunity for rest. Now the implication here is that the New Testament Jesus, which by the way is the counterpart of the Old Covenant Yeshua, Jesus the Greek, Yeshua the Hebrew, both mean Jesus, God saves. Yahweh saves, Yeshua. Jesus is simply the Greek counterpart. So he's playing on names here. What he's saying, in effect, is that the New Testament Yeshua, remember that Jesus was named Jesus because he shall save them from their sins? New Testament Yeshua is superior to the Old Testament Yeshua because he is offering the rest which Joshua did not realize, not able to realize with regard to the people of Israel. So again, he is countering really two possible arguments, that God's rest no longer exists, or that God's rest exists, but faith is irrelevant. The argument is that God's rest exists, and that faith is indispensable to realizing the experience of God's rest, sharing God's rest with. Okay, are we clear on that? Any questions on that? All right, let's move then to 4.9, which is his final conclusion from this argument. Now I'll ask one of you to paraphrase this conclusion. Final conclusion involving causation, as is indicated by the conjunction with which 4.9 begins. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Sabbath rest goes back to creation. With substantiation and clarification in 4.10 based on comparison. Let me ask first of all someone to paraphrase 4.9, including the causal connection between 4.9 and what precedes. How would you do that? I wonder if you would try your hand at that, please, Charles. What are I would look primarily for the reasons why he says God's rest continues to exist. What are those reasons, as we found them in this material?
Because God rested on the seventh day
after creation. All right, let's put this down here so we can follow. Because, when you say because God's rest continues to exist, what you're really repeating is the conclusion of 5.9, namely, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. So actually what you're stating is the result, not the causes, you say. So let's state the causes. What are the causes for this conclusion in 4.9? Try to incorporate that into a paraphrase.
Because David said so long afterwards. David heard the question.
All right, that's actually the third reason he gives. He gives three reasons here, doesn't he? Count both explicit reasons and the implicit reasons. That's the third reason he gives in verse 7. Let's back up now to where he starts discussing this whole matter of the existence of the rest of God. Right. Maybe even in 3a. All right, that's actually the second reason. So let's pick up the first one that precedes that. If indeed the use of the future tense in 3a is significant in this connection. All right. What you want to do is to that's the first reason. What you want to do is get behind the statement as to what's being emphasized concerning the rest of God in the statement. Okay. Let me begin stating it here, because let's say Psalm 95 uses the future tense regarding the Israelites not realizing God's rest instead of the past tense. Thus implying that the possibility of rest still continues. What he's saying is not merely they did not, they have not, but even though in the future it's possible to enter this rest, they shall never enter it. See? When he says they shall never enter it, it means it's still a possibility, but they will never realize it. See? So the future tense of the verb may well be significant here. All right, now let's talk about creation. And because, go ahead and get the argument about creation.
Because God's works were finished on the seventh day of the rest of
it. All right, but you need to add something else to that now, because that's merely past. What about this rest of God? Yeah, and why can people still enter the rest of God, which began following creation? Yes, but what's implied about God's rest, if it still can be entered? It still exists, yes. So you have to say, and because God's rest, which began after creation, is still continuing, and therefore is still possible for you. They're supposed to share the rest of God. If God is not resting, they can't share his rest. Now you come to today in Psalm 95. Okay, we've gotten two of them. One, the future tense in Psalm 25. Secondly, God's rest, which of course involves Genesis 2. Now you come to the third one, going back to the Psalm and involving the argument today. Verse 7, what's that argument?
Well, only because David spoke in the psalm 500 years after Israel entered the promised land.
I followed your statement here, and I realize I'm behind the desk now. I would make it a little clearer, I think, by saying, and because David used today, the word today in Psalm 95, 500 years after the